as if your boat fouls their lines, you will be marked for death. When hiring someone to do a job, don't ask how much it will cost. That kind of curiosity will mark you as an outsider. And it was true that first summer when we had to hire people to fill up propane tanks again and do all the other things that we couldn't, that the very idea of openly trading money for services was treated like a confusing breach of etiquette. We wanted some trees cut down, for example, so that we could see the muddy bay a little, and to deny the mosquitoes some small percentage of still air and damp nesting pools. We followed the rules, naturally. We had a local forest warden come out first. Mostly you can defile your property however you want in Maine. If your neighbor, for example, clear-cuts the forest on his land and erects a goofy, giant Lincoln log house with a golden cupola on it, there is no homeowners association to step in and police their awful taste. Even if they put a pen out and fill it with llamas and donkeys, that is their strange private universe they are building, and it must not be disturbed by you. You must train yourself to not hear or see or smell those donkeys and llamas. But within 75 feet of the shore, state regulations kick in regarding drainage and runoff. You cannot denude the shoreline the way the first generation of ravaging wealthy Bostonians did, casting their perfect lawns to the sea. So the forest warden tramped through our small strip of woods, inspecting the trees and their age, measuring their distance from each other, tying bows on those that must be kept. The rest were dead or dense enough to be doomed. My wife's uncle suggested we call a person named Jerry to cut down the trees. I still don't know his last name. I was told to call. No text, no email. And so I called, and I left a voicemail message. It was very quaint and time-travel-y. But Jerry did not call back. Days later, we were considering who else to call, when Jerry just drove up in his truck. He was a tall, lanky guy in his 30s. His visit amounted to him looking at our woods and saying, "Yeah," and then driving away. We did not discuss money. Days passed again. We were confused. Had Jerry forgotten about us? Had he gotten another job? Should I put some pressure on him? Is another voicemail enough, or do I need to go so far as to send him a fax? Then that morning, we woke up to a buzzing, and then that sharp, hollow, baseball bat crack of a trunk giving way, followed by the cascading tumult and crash of tree fall, sounding almost like surf. Jerry had come to cut down our woods. We ran downstairs. It was like Christmas, except in this case, Santa has a chainsaw, and you get to kill a whole lot of pine trees instead of just one. Jerry came cutting for 2 days, and then he disappeared for a while, and then he came back for a third day. When Jerry was cutting, we canceled our morning plans to watch from the screen porch. It was like a monster was crashing through the woods. You couldn't see the monster, only the trees shuddering first at the top and then collapsing in its wake. Every now and then, though, we could hear Jerry laugh, or a falling tree would reveal him briefly with his boots and his gloves and his chainsaw. Maybe I saw him wearing eye protection, but I'm not really sure. He was just alone, unaided, happily fighting with a forest. Eventually, Jerry cut up all the trunks and stacked the wood for us and went away. Some days later, almost as an afterthought, he came back with a number on a piece of paper. I don't remember the number, but it was very low. In honor of ancient technology, I wrote him a personal check, which he put in his jeans pocket and left. We barely spoke. At first I thought Jerry was so distant because we were from away, but after watching him cut, I decided that it was simply that he didn't have time to waste on us. He liked cutting down trees and whatever else he liked when he went back to his own private world, and he was not going to spend a lot of time opening up to me when the days in Maine shortened so quickly. Eventually, my wife and I began to suspect that her father's reverence for privacy, his fear of being branded an outsider, was really a trick that he used to mask his own desire to be left alone. Which is, of course, what makes him native. The famous writer was not a native of Maine. He was from New York, but he found in Maine the same thing that my father-in-law and my wife discovered, and that Jerry was born into. A love of the natural world, and a desire to keep human interaction to a minimum. He was already famous when he worked in New York, but he didn't want to be. When people would come to see him, he would flee his office using the fire escape. When he moved to Maine, he avoided most weddings and other large gatherings. He raised chickens. Once he wrote about how his hens had laid surplus eggs. But he wouldn't take those extra eggs to sell at the town store out of some opaque combination of reticence, shame, and shyness that my wife cannot quite figure out because the writer didn't really bother to describe it. It was as if to describe that part of himself would be the same as pointing out that he was born with a nose, but he still had it and still used it to breathe. Needless words. Look, I'm not going to be cute. You can figure out who I'm talking about here very easily. You can figure out the name of his town, and then you can find that town, and you can come and kill me and my family. But you will gain no happiness from doing that, and I trust that you won't. One thing I've learned in the public eye is that if you give people a measure of trust not to invade your privacy, they largely don't. It helps if you are only book famous and not actually famous. And no matter how close I might have come to being the latter, the fact that I am reading this to you now proves I will always actually be the former. The famous writer eventually died, and his house was put up for sale without ceremony. He did not want it to become a museum or a shrine. A married couple who are not famous writers bought it and live there still. And whether out of special respect for their privacy, or the famous writer's legacy of fame, or just out of decency, the location of this particular local point of interest is not celebrated, and definitely not advertised around town. It's usually not discussed at all. It was a long time before we knew about the house, and longer before we knew where it was. But eventually, the information was slipped to us, and we received it as a gift of trust. When my wife's mother came to visit that first summer, she asked that we take her to the famous writer's house so she could take pictures of it, and my wife told her no. And this gave my wife tremendous pleasure, for many complicated reasons. When we learned the location of the famous writer's house, we realized we had been driving by it all the time for weeks. Now that we knew, we would not even slow down as we drove by. We would catch little flashes of it in the corners of our eyes, assembling an image of it, piece by piece, into something that we could look at in our minds later. Over time, my wife received more information about the house. She didn't ask anyone. She's her father's daughter. She just gleaned it. From many conversations around town, she pieced together a story that grew in the telling each time we drove by. The couple who lived there were older than us. They were childless. The house was getting to be too much for them. They would be selling it soon, but they were waiting for the right person. They were waiting for someone who knew how special the house was, the kind of person who reads aloud from the writer's books to her husband in the car, and then that person and her husband both fight off tears because of the kinship that she feels for this writer and his love of Maine. And when the current owners find that person, they will sell it to her, and it won't matter that she and her husband had just bought a home in the same town and cannot afford a third summer home, because they were going to sell it to her for a single dollar. That was the story. My wife's information was not accurate. First of all, no one told my wife that the house would be sold for a dollar except her own hoping brain. And second of all, the couple who own the house definitely have children, as I would soon learn. My wife's delusion was born only out of an affection for the famous writer, which also extends to his heirs, who still live in town and deserve their privacy, and her affection also extends to the couple who own the house now, whom we've never met, whose own affection for its legacy is shown by their immaculate upkeep of it. It's not a shrine, it's not a museum, but it is perfectly preserved. Or maybe, unlike us, they are simply not garbage people who know how to take care of a house. Whatever the case, I ask only that my neighbors in town do not blame my wife for what I am about to reveal, or for the fact that I've already said too much. I wasn't going to write about the famous writer at all. I was going to keep the secret. But I was thinking of him last summer while sitting on the screen porch. It was the same screen porch where we had watched Jerry tear through our woods the summer before, but now we were in the middle of a different reaping. Two black men, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, had just been killed by the police in rapid succession in Louisiana and Minnesota, respectively. Their deaths were the most recent iteration of a pattern of similar killings of unarmed people of color stretching shamefully far back and reaching far nearer in time than most white people wanted to admit. If you were not a victim of the pattern, and statistically speaking, if you are white, you aren't, it was easy not to see it. It was easy to picture the news of each killing as unconnected points, distant and discrete stars out there in space that we could only see fuzzily from a distance and behind which we would console ourselves lurked no angels. But with the iPhone, Steve Jobs stole the internet from the desktops of the relatively few white nerds who had previously dominated its user base, and put that internet in the hands of millions more. And many of those hands, who will soon be the majority of the United States, are brown. There is no privacy anymore. With a civilian surveillance device in everyone's hands, the pattern could not be hidden, not even in Maine. We had video. We could see the similarity of the killings as they tumbled one after one into our feeds. The specific details, the mitigating circumstances, the tragic split-second decisions blurring into what could not be denied. A pattern, self-similar and replicating, seemingly infinite, seemingly unstoppable, an ugly fractal of injustice with cruel edges twisting in on itself, choking out life. You had to see it, though many tried not to, and tried hard. In different parts of the world, protests sprung up to defend the humanity of the specific people who had been killed, as well as non-white people everywhere. Some white people found that standing up for the humanity of non-white people somehow threatened their humanity, and made a point of saying so on the internet a lot. They fought the Black Lives Matter idea with such a fervor that it was unseemly and dumb. It reminded me of the offense I took when I realized I wouldn't live forever. How dare you suggest that I'm not the hero of this story? I am a straight white man. I have been right at the center of this culture for a long time. Now you ask me to be quiet for a few days? To listen to someone else's experience? Look, I know that you will soon outnumber me, and my ability to define reality will soon disappear. But not yet. I am still here. You need to listen to me when I say that my life matters, because I am secretly not sure of it anymore. I'm still cool. I'm still relevant. And here are some horrible, badly designed memes to prove it. It wasn't just aging guys like me anymore. It was as if all of whiteness was going through a desperate midlife crisis. I was ashamed. Even after a summer in Maine, at the tannest I would ever get, you could see the blue veins in my forearms, so thin is the skin of my people. But I felt worse because I knew where I was. The killings and their aftermaths were on the internet, The internet was in my lap on my screen porch in Maine, 94% white as of 2013, and if I closed my laptop, I could make it all vanish. Now, Maine is a tolerant place. It is a wide range of political thought and lifestyles within it, generally moderated by a let's-not-talk-about-politics-or-pretty-much-anything policy suitable to the region's temperament. The coast has a leftward lean, where it's not inhabited by bushes. With our peninsula long attracting artists and free thinkers, including a bakery staffed by elfin, starry-eyed young people that I am pretty sure is a free love cult. Sometime after I first met our neighbors, the non-vampires, I learned that our private Rotten Rock Road, which I had taken as a symbol of my journey into dull conservative adulthood, was actually named for Mildred Harris, who with her life partner, Freda Gertz, built their house on the road in the 1970s. Now, Freda was an artist and a Red Sox fan. Mildred, a physical therapist and expert in Jungian analysis. As far as I can tell, they were well-liked, and their partnership utterly uncontroversial in town. Their final years were spent on their lobster boat, ordering their hired captain around as they went out in search of mackerel. I've been on that boat since. It's an honest and unflashy craft, never used for lobstering, purposed unapologetically to spending time while it lasted with beloved things. And I take it as a reminder to never underestimate the cool of your elders. They might happen to be a kick-ass pair of lesbian superwomen who lived exactly the fuck they wanted to, even in what we now consider to be less enlightened times. What's more, there are sizable communities of immigrants from Somalia, Rwanda, and other African countries that are invigorating failing towns like Lewiston and offering even additional vibrancy and diversity to Portland, a city that is so young and diverse and vibrant and cool that it is known as the Portland of Maine. But this is also true. Maine's governor, as I speak to you, is a foul-mouthed bigot who openly accuses black men of crossing the southern border into Maine specifically to A, sell drugs, and B, have sex with white women. And well before there was the Trump administration, there was the Paul LePage constituency, which also took roots in a white conservative working class who had lost their manufacturing jobs and were watching their kids succumb to an epidemic of heroin and other opiates. I'm not suggesting that LePage voters are necessarily racist. I would posit that even those of my neighbors who actually are racist would never act upon those prejudices. They would probably offer a person of color from away the same taciturn blank stare they offer me. The difference is that I never have to worry about it. I never have to worry about whether someone is a racist because I am white. And the racists don't need to worry about racism either. Because, just speaking statistically, there are hardly any other races to see. I've picked up hitchhikers twice in my life, both in Maine. The first time was a young couple who flagged us down as we were driving the Loop Road in Acadia National Park. They had gotten lost hiking and were looking for a ride back to the parking lot. When they got in the car, they said, "Are you John Hodgman?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Oh, wow, we are huge fans of your podcast." And I said, "Well, this must be very surprising for you." And they said, "It is." And I said, "What's even more surprising is that usually it's the hitchhikers who end up murdering the driver and not the other way around, like this time." It was just another example of the wit and wisdom of me at my finest. I didn't kill them. They were nice. We met up later in Brooklyn because, of course, that is where they live. The second time I picked up a hitchhiker was last summer. We were driving out to see my father-in-law. It was a hot day. We were not far from the Kingdom property and the yacht club when we saw a black woman in her 20s with her thumb out. This was such a profoundly uncommon thing to see that it unnerved us. We worried that she was in trouble. She wasn't. She sighed happily as she climbed into the AC of our car. "Phew," she said. She told us she was just going a few miles up the way to her parents' house. "Do you not have a car?" I asked. Not anymore, she said. But I usually get a ride. I'm pretty well known around here. Once in Bar Harbor, I saw an older, affluent black couple sitting on the porch of the ice cream parlor. They were on the same side of the table, facing out toward the town green. They were just silently watching the parade of well-heeled Caucasians walk by. They were sharing a vanilla ice cream cone. I could not guess what they were thinking about. Maine is a beautiful place, a place that I paradoxically want to hoard to myself and share with everyone I meet. But that day on the screen porch, I thought, shamefully for the first time, about what it would be like to be a non-white person visiting Maine, how it might be glorious and wonderful, but necessarily complicated to see so little of yourself. I knew, shamefully for the first time, that when I closed the internet today, I could go out into my community and never have to think about race for another second of the day. I don't know what it was about that particular morning on the screen porch that made me feel this so keenly. I should have known it all along. So that summer, I thought about the famous writer in a new way. It won't surprise you to know that he is white, and he wrote about the rhythms of his life in this white place. There's nothing wrong in this. All places and experience deserve writing about. But what made the writer a greater hero to me in that moment was that, unlike so many white men, he wasn't braggy. He never suggested that his experience was heroic or correct or even unusual. In fact, it was profoundly usual and beautifully mundane and merely his to offer. His offering was his insight into the small joys of his particular life, which by extension could help us recognize the small joys that exist everywhere, even outside of Maine. And he offered it humbly. You really should use your detective skills and find his work. He's great. We who are white men can't change who we are. But we could do worse than follow what I took that summer as his example. To be aware of and curious about the whole world around you. To give what you have with neither apology nor self-congratulation. When praise comes to you, get out on the fire escape. When it's someone else's time to talk, listen. Don't turn your house into a shrine or a museum. When your work is done, get out of the way. I resolved to be disciplined in following this lesson. But then, someone posted a photo on the internet that made me mad. This was some weeks later, and because it was summer in Maine, my wife had built a huge fire in the fireplace. I was lying on the sofa, and I wanted to see what photos people had taken of this part of Maine, so I did a search for our peninsula on a popular social media platform. Mostly I found a bunch of pictures of rocky beaches and of kayaks and docks and buoys and junk. There were pictures of dogs and cats and food, of course. Someone was posting pictures of their cracked foundation. And then I saw the young couple, standing in front of a porch, arm in arm, smiling for the camera. I knew that porch. Even if I had only seen it in dozens of split-second drive-bys. And in case I wasn't sure, the photo was named, tagged, and pinned on a map. It was the house of the famous writer. How do I describe this couple without invading their privacy? They were young, white, beautiful, and happy. The account belonged to the beautiful young woman. The caption suggested the handsome young man on her arm was related to the current owners of the writer's house, who clearly did have children after all. I scrolled deeper into her feed. They were clearly about to graduate from college or had done so recently. They were travelers. Here they were in Europe. Here they were at an American country club. Here they were on a beach. Here they were in the mountains. Each jaunt posted just days after the last. Either the photos had been stored up, or they were speeding through the world on an insane grand tour. They were doing nothing wrong. They were reveling in the joys of their particular lives, and they were sharing their selfie triumphs with a verve entirely common and appropriate to their age. It was wrong for me to think that they were embodying the worst of whiteness, the casual, unquestioning acceptance of good fortune in the form of money, perhaps, or opportunity, or skin that lets you pass through the world with a smile, or a house in Maine, famous for someone else's work and passing it off as if you earned it all yourself, or beyond earning, simply deserving. Did they think this way? Who knows? Perhaps they are more woke than I will ever be. Was I any better than they? I was worse, because I was the creep stalking them then and talking about them now. But I couldn't help but feel desperate and mad. Not only had they revealed the secret of the famous writer's house, but they would probably live in it one day, and they would not sell it to my wife for a dollar. I shared this with my wife, and she instructed me that I should just forget it, and I should have listened to her. But handsome young man and beautiful young woman haunted me. One evening, I went deeper into the feed than I had ever gone before. I was like Ant-Man at the end of Ant-Man, shrinking deeper and deeper into the dark microverse, where I finally found a photo taken at the house that pushed me over the edge into new, previously undiscovered dimensions of smallness. There is a famous photo of the famous writer at work. He is sitting at a manual typewriter in a plain shed, a bare plank for a desk, not even a window, so much as a square hole in the wall, open to the water and sky. This shed apparently is still there. Beautiful young woman took a picture of herself, sitting at the plank, pretending to write, a replica of the older photo. She placed the two images together. Here is a photo of the author writing all their famous novels and essays, she wrote in the caption. And here is an old man sitting in the same place. I saw this, and I did the wrong thing. I scrolled down, and I left a comment. I will not reveal what I said, not to protect myself, but because it's a direct reference to the famous writer's work. I will tell you it was extremely clever. My internet comment was literary and oblique, a deft critique of hubris and odious comparison, but all it really was an insult. I am the villain of this story. I was a 45-year-old man trolling a young woman in her 20s who was simply making a joke. I guess I just wanted to explain to her everything that was wrong with the way she saw the world and was living her life, just like every other dude on the internet. What's so wrong with that? After all, there is no mansplaining like white mansplaining, 'cause white mansplaining don't stop. My insulting her was an insult also to the famous writer and my own soul. But I won't lie about it. I did it. And I am ashamed to admit that it took me 24 hours to delete my comment. I hope she and her handsome young man have a wonderful time visiting and later owning the house of the famous writer. I am grateful to be reminded of how vigilant I need to be about my skin and its thinness and the responsibilities both entail. I apologize to her for what I said. And I apologize to her and to the owners of the house for apologizing here in this way. I couldn't do it in the comments, because a few days later, I noticed her account had gone private. You are normal people. In the middle of our first summer in Maine, as our children ignored us, something happened. Left to our own devices, my wife and I fulfilled our Caucasian class destiny in the most loathsome way possible. I feel embarrassed even now, admitting to you what we did. But I have promised to be truthful, and so now I confess. We bought a boat. In our defense, I offer it as not a yacht or anything, just a 13-foot rowboat, and B, we bought it by accident. I'm sure you have also bought a boat by accident, so at the risk of boring you, here is our story. As July ended, flyers started going up outside the general stores of our town and many more around it. The flyers advertised a charity auction to be held some Saturdays from now to benefit a church whose roof was failing. People had donated many things to be auctioned, but the premier item was a wooden Jimmy Steele peapod. Now, you don't know what a Jimmy Steele peapod is, because you are a normal person. I didn't know what it was either. But as conversation spread across the peninsula about the auction and the peapod, I learned. A peapod is a style of rowboat that is about 12 to 15 feet long and pointed on both ends, like a peapod, get it? It's very typical to this stretch of Maine because it is very stable and heavy, good in choppy waters and rowable in both directions. It can also take a very rudimentary boomless sail called a spritsel, which is a word that I learned. Before there were motors, it was the traditional craft of the Maine lobsterman. He would stand up, rowing his peapod into and out of the coves with long oars, hauling up lobster pots, his foot braced flat on the gunwale, which is another word that I learned, without fear of tipping. And then he could bring up the sail and let the prevailing winds carry him back to shore, thus making a living entirely on his own, almost without ever having to see or speak to another human ever in his life, which I am convinced is the secret dream of every person in Maine. I've mentioned that ours is a town of boat builders, many employed by the big former cannery that was transformed in the 60s by the son of the famous writer into a boat-building yard. The son of the famous writer did not want to be a writer. He wanted to design and build wooden boats in the traditional style, and he is famous for doing exactly that. The boatyard, along with the boat-building school he also helped to found, are a double mecca for the weird dads who follow that sort of thing. But the town is also home to many solo wooden boat builders, and one of those was Jimmy Steele, whose old workshop still sits at the head of the flat, muddy bay. Jimmy Steele died in 2007. He built not only boats, but also a lot of the homes in town, including Percy's. Everyone has a story about him, and the impending sale of one of his peapods shook these stories out of people's memories. As you know, I am changing the names of many people in this book, but I will identify my neighbor, Brian Larkin, because I think that he would enjoy it. And he has taken us out on his own boat to many interesting islands, and if he's wrong about any of this, I want him to take the blame. Brian is also a boat builder. One day he realized he was running low on white oak, which is a kind of wood, I guess. Don't ask me. I'm not a builder of traditional wooden boats. Brian went to Jimmy's workshop and asked his neighbor if he could buy some white oak off of him. And Jimmy told Brian that he was not in the business of selling fucking lumber, so get out. Brian, who is native to Maine, seemed to anticipate this possible response and thus, politely, got the fuck out. The next day, Brian was at work when he heard the noise of an engine outside his shop. It was Jimmy Steele in his truck. His truck was full of white oak. Jimmy Steele dumped the wood into Brian's dooryard and said, "There's your goddamn wood." I like to think about what happened in the brain of Jimmy Steele during the hours that passed between Brian getting the fuck out and the dumping of the goddamn wood. I like to think that Brian's simple request made Jimmy angry not merely because it was an intrusion, but because it added a chore to his life that he did not choose for himself. And yet, once the request fell upon Jimmy Steele's brain, he couldn't shake it. It became a curse of neighborly obligation that could not be lifted until he dumped the magic wood. And then he would be free again to go back into his solitude, and next time, not even answer the door. I don't know if Jimmy Steele thought that way, but I like to think he did, because that's how I think a lot of the time, and I want to feel normal. And it would prove my maxim about favors, which is the exact opposite of what your encouraging parents have always told you. It does, in fact, always hurt to ask. Brian watched Jimmy dump the wood and said thank you. He asked Jimmy what he owed him, and Jimmy barked back at him, "Nothing!" and drove away. I obviously wished to see a boat built by such generous and angry hands, so we went to the auction. We were not alone. There must have been 50 or 60 people there, and I am confident they did not come for the rest of the junk that was on offer. It was just old half sets of Candyland and hair dryers and unmatched ski poles and other miscellany, all tagged and arrayed on tables in the high school gymnasium. It looked like the last recovered items of a town that had been blown away in a tornado. I swear, someone was auctioning a Folgers coffee can full of nickels. But there was the Peapod, just outside the gym in the sun. It was beautiful. Every piece of goddamn wood bent and fitted together like the elegant solution to some three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle Jimmy Steele saw in his mind and was compelled to solve. There was speculation over how much it would sell for. One of our neighbors, Heidi, a writer, offered to stake us to a bid of $2,000. She is from Maine originally. Heidi is the one who introduced us to the town, where she and her husband, also a writer, spend the summer. We're very fond of Heidi and her husband, but even though they also live in New York, and even though we make every promise to see them during the winter, we somehow never do. I suspect this is because Heidi, like my wife, would prefer to pretend that the non-main portion of her life is not actually happening. But even Heidi knew her $2,000 gambit was symbolic only. She figured it would sell for much more than that. And now that I examined its varnished rails and other beautiful boat parts that I did not and still do not know, I knew she was right. In fact, the minimum bid was listed at $3,500, and it included a trailer. My wife felt the same way I did about the Peapod. We didn't talk about it. I just knew. It's when we start talking that the misunderstandings start. I said, "Listen, I can tell that you want this boat. And for some reason, suddenly, so do I. But we both know it's going to get very expensive very quickly once the bidding starts. So here is my suggestion. Why don't you make the opening bid? Bid the $3,500 and then stop. We won't win the boat, but we can watch the bidding play out and enjoy knowing that we had some small part in it, some small part in launching this boat, this beautiful piece of ingenious, practical sculpture onto whatever waters it travels." And my wife said, "Once again, you have proven that you are America's greatest living storyteller. I will do what you suggest." She did not say that. She said, "That is stupid. No." But when the auction finally occurred, we both grabbed folding seats near the front as the auctioneer made short work of all the gymnasium garbage and got to the main event. "We come now to the Jimmy Steele Peapod," he said. And everyone in the room took one solid step forward. Unlike the earlier auctioneer, this guy knew his stuff. Now, Jim Steele made 178 Peapods over the course of his career. The one we have for auction today is later, number 104, I believe. Before we begin, does anyone know how much the first Jimmy Steele Peapod sold for? This would have been in 1964. No? Anyone? Can anyone guess? No one was guessing. I do not know what came over me, but finally I just farted out of my mouth the words, $100. The auctioneer turned on me, furious. "That's correct," he said. I had stolen his punchline. He turned back to the crowd. "The last Jimmy Steele Peapod to come up for auction was in 2009. Does anyone know what that Peapod sold for? Anyone? A pointed glare at me. Any guesses from the expert? I will not lie to you. I knew what it sold for, and I believe in science. But I am not lying when some telepathic spark that connected me to this angry auctioneer and the boat that was in his charge told me the answer. But I knew not to speak. I do not know. I lied. He was triumphant. $10,000, he announced. The audience murmured in appreciative surprise, but I think they probably knew, too. This was their world. Bidding began. I was glad I was not going to buy a $10,000 boat today. As advertised, the auctioneer opened with a request for $3,500 minimum bid. It took some time for people to get interested. My wife was still not sold on my poetic first bid scheme, but through a series of urgent eyebrow movements, I bullied her into raising her paddle. $3,500, she said. I have $3,500 to the woman in the front row. Now who'll give me $3,600? Who'll give me 36? Do I hear 36 in the back? 36? Who'll give me 36? Looking for 36 now. I have $3,500. Who'll give me 36? Who'll give me 36? No one would give him 36. Finally, the auctioneer shamed a tall man with thick glasses into a bid of 36. Come on, Dan. Surely you'll go to 36. Dan sighed. He went to 36. But now, however, my wife was in it. Something had flipped in her the moment Dan made the mistake to challenge her. As soon as his limping six was out of his mouth, her paddle shot up. 37! Now we had an auction. I have 37, said the auctioneer. Now who'll give me 38? Dan, will you go to 38? Dan, will you give me 38? Dan was aggrieved. I already have a Peapod, he said with a shrug, as if to convey, what more do you want of me? The auctioneer was disgusted with Dan. He turned back to the crowd. Who'll give me 38 for this Jimmy Steele Peapod? It includes a trailer, a rudder, and the spritzel. It's a piece of history, ladies and gentlemen. So now who'll give me 38? Who'll give me 38? I have 37 here in the front. Now who'll give me 38? 38, please. $3,800, and Tom, the owner, will drive it to your home. Who'll give me 38? Who'll give me 38, please? This is a Jimmy Steele Peapod. That's the reason we are all here. Who will give me 38? I'm looking for 38, please. Who'll give me 38? No one would give him 38. Not one person in the world. Everyone in the gymnasium looked down at their feet and now took one solid step backward, leaving only my wife in the glare of a single shaft of white sunlight angling from the gymnasium window. I did not understand what was happening. Finally, the auctioneer finished it, like an angry engine that has died at the top of a hill. 37 going once. 37 going twice, and then a pause for roughly 12 hours, before he said, sold, and he looked at my wife, to you. At that moment, we owned a boat, and at that moment, everyone who had been staring down at their feet looked up and smiled at my wife. A short line grew to congratulate her. Congratulations, they said, one by one. A Jimmy Steele Peapod for $3,700. What a bargain. Good for you. She wrote the check out to benefit the church roof. As Tom hitched up the trailer to his truck to drive the boat home for us, they all came up one by one, smiling and repeating, good for you. What a bargain. A Jimmy Steele Peapod for $3,700. What a bargain. Good for you. This went on for the rest of the summer. People stopping us at the library or the store or the boatyard, commenting on the boat, commenting on the bargain. Some weeks after the auction, I was checking our post office box. It's number 117. If you can figure out where we live and Claire at the P.O. hasn't canceled it by then because we don't check it all winter, you can send me a letter there. But please don't go to the post office and approach me. That would be weird. I was alone in the little room of metal post office box doors when I got approached. It was the owner of the local inn. I had never met him, We were the only ones there. I swear it. He said, "Are you the one who bought the Jimmy Steele pea pod?" And I said, "Yes, I'm John." "Right," he said. "How much did you pay for it again?" And I said, "I think you know." "It was $3,700. $3,700, he said. "What a bargain." And then he said, "Hey, I want you to meet someone. I am telling you that we were the only ones in the post office box room." But somehow, the innkeeper produced a whole woman. From somewhere behind his back emerged an older, handsome, strict-looking woman, and the innkeeper said, "Pam, I want you to meet John. He bought a Jimmy Steele pea pod for $3,700 at auction." And I said, "Well, my wife bought it, actually. I do not feel that white dudes need to take credit for everything, especially when it feels like a couple of locals are playing some weird mind game with me, perhaps as a prelude to murder." "John," the innkeeper continued, "I want you to meet Pam Steele. Pam is Jim Steele's widow." Every molecule in the air reversed its charge. I said some polite words to Pam Steele that I don't remember. I knew that I was in the living presence of a history that I knew nothing about before I saw this boat, and now I was being judged by that history. Pam Steele placidly held me with her eyes. "I wanted to meet the person who paid $3,700 for one of Jim's boats," she said. And then she peered through me for a bit, coming to some silent determination of her own. "Good for you," she said. And then she left the post office. "What is going on?" I wanted to say to the innkeeper. "Is this some sort of ritual? Do you do this every year? You hold a bogus auction, and then you trick some couple from away into buying a pea pod. And once they make that winning bid, do you befriend them? You feed them, fatten them with compliments, you make them feel they're welcome. And then, after some time of ripening, do you bring them before the widow for judgment? Do you wait until the end of the summer to harvest them? Do you sneak into their homes on the eve of the town fair and drug them with strange, pungent herbs? Do you take them down to the fairgrounds at dawn, where they will awaken, tied to a stake, surrounded by the townspeople and their silent children? Does one mother cluck and tend to one small, complaining child who does not understand the ceremony? Does that little boy or girl look to the suspended feet of the people from away, my wife and I, who cannot speak except with our wide, white eyes because we are gagged and bound fast? Does that little boy or girl say, 'Where's the wood, Mommy? Where is the wood for the fire?' And at that moment, does some old man drive up in his truck? Does the crowd part as he backs in, barely looking in the rear view, so assured he is of the dimensions of his vehicle and his world, this world to which my wife and I do not belong? Does he dump out his payload of white oak at our feet, seasoned 3 summers in a hot, dry shed, to take fire quick and hungrily on this morning? Does he say to the little girl or boy, to my wife and me, to the town, 'There's your goddamn wood'? And then, when it's all done, when the smoke and silent, pointless struggling ends, and what's left is cleared away, when the fair opens to the public that first day, and an antique tractor stands bright red in the spot where we died, will you all take the pea pod back then and store it for another year? And will your children be safe for that year, safe from the cold and famished ocean, safe from the clams that sing to them from the bottom of the lake?" None of those things happened, of course. I did not say those things, and my wife and I were not burned alive. I took my mail, and I went home. Maine is not a death cult. I mean, it is, but it's a slow one. It creeps in like the tide. And without your even noticing, the ground around you is swallowed by water until it's gone. By the time we got the pea pod in the water, it was getting cold. Leaves were yellowing on the trees, and you could already see the light was lower in the sky. Autumn was here. It was August 1st. Vacation Land. I've been pretty coy so far on the subject of my mother and her death. I was 29 when she died. She was 58. I had been married to my wife less than a year, but we had been together already for 10. In many ways, she had become my mom's daughter, too. What more is there to say than it was traumatic, a moment that breaks your life in half, that you never heal from it, and it blankets your life in sadness and fear forever? There isn't much to say, except for this little bit. She had been diagnosed with lung cancer the previous fall. The cancer was as deliberate and strong and persistent as she had always been. By the time she was dying, it was spring. I had been finishing my 7th year working at a literary agency. I loved my colleagues, I loved my clients. I loved an industry that encouraged long lunches and still closed early on Fridays once the summer started sneaking up. But I was unhappy. I wanted to be a writer, and that meant I could not be an agent in good faith and compete with my own clients. And, oh, I also was unhappy because my mom was dying. So one Friday I left work, and I did not go back. I went home to help my father take care of her. She was in a hospital bed at home by then. My father and I would keep her company and watch movies. I don't know whether it was the drugs or the cancer, but her mind had broken by then. She was spacey. She lost track of days and people. She said weird things and got fixated on certain ideas. She became obsessed with going back to New York to see Cats, which was still running then. I called about tickets, but all the wheelchair seats were booked until long after she would surely be gone. Old friends would come to dinner and we'd eat together around her bed. After eating, she'd have a cigarette. She had taken up smoking again. It didn't matter anymore. When the old friends said goodbye, they knew it was forever. Night after night this happened. But somehow, it didn't feel terrible. Slow death keeps you busy with chores and distractions. I loved the time I spent with her. She had no hair left, just a bit of suede on her scalp. I liked the way it smelled when I kissed her on the head goodnight. A combination of baby powder and iodine. I've never smelled anything like it since. When I was little, I found a paperback copy of The Exorcist in the hall closet. I only read the back cover, but I became scared for a full year that I would be possessed by the devil. Possession by the devil was a powerful fantasy for an only child sleeping alone in the top bunk of a bunk bed with only shadow and empty space below him for company. It didn't matter how good you were or how closely you followed the rules. The devil didn't care. The devil wanted you, he got you. The girl who was possessed in The Exorcist first felt the devil coming when her bed started shaking, and I would lie awake at night and wonder when I would feel the first shake. And soon enough, my bed did start shaking. It was a rickety bed, and my heart was beating so hard. I went in to see my parents. My father was asleep, but my mom was still awake, reading and smoking. I confessed I was afraid of the devil. She said, "Don't worry, there is no devil." I said, "There isn't?" And she said, "That's right." She told me then for the first time that she was an atheist. "There can't be a devil," she said, "because there is no God." I remember admiring my mother. She was funny, and she was honest. But this was not a comfort to me. After a few weeks caring for my mom at home, I noticed that none of my clients missed me. They wished me well, of course, they cared about me. But to my surprise, their personal and professional lives did not collapse without my being there to tend to them. I was not essential to their world at all. Eventually my mom declined, and she went to the hospital. My dad and I slept in her room. More visitors came. More goodbyes were said. At some point I asked her if she was at peace with the idea of dying, and she looked at me like I was stupid and insane. "No," she said. "I don't want to die, I want to live." "You idiot," would have finished the sentence nicely. It was one of the only times she seemed really disappointed in me. I realized that I had learned everything I know about death from movies. In truth, there is no peace in dying. She was still an atheist, but she had taken to saying the Lord's Prayer. It was a revisiting of her own lapsed and comforting rituals and maybe a hedging of her bets. My non-Catholic wife taught her the Protestant add-on to the end of the prayer. "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen." I still say it from time to time, to remember her. My friend Liz came to town. She was promoting her novel. I don't know why, but I asked her if she believed in an afterlife. I don't know if she was lying or not, but she said yes. She said, "Yes, I believe it. I believe in all of it. I believe in everything." I appreciated her kindness. I wanted to be comforted. But this was not a comfort to me. One night, my father, my wife, and I went back to my parents' house to sleep in non-hospital beds. Liz was still in town. She and my wife and I were sitting in the kitchen talking, and the phone rang. I answered it. "There's no peace in dying, but there's peace when it's done." I went back to New York, accepted the condolences of my friends and colleagues, and then quit my job. I was back home in Massachusetts within a week. A friend at a magazine assigned me to write an article about cheese for money. I became a professional writer. I spent the summer there in Brookline with my dad and my wife. I didn't cry until the summer was over. We went back to New York, and I started a new life. It was the year 2000. None of this is anything you needed to know to understand that I am sad my mother died. It's not even worth mentioning, except I have to tell you that in order to tell you this. I wish she were alive, but I am grateful for her death. If she were alive, I would likely still be working at the literary agency. For how much longer in my life would I believe there was time for everything? And by the time I faced my own mortality at the book mill in Western Massachusetts, how much less would I have done? Her leaving me taught me about the worst sadness, the one we must all face eventually. I feel lucky I am better equipped to help others who are going through it now. She left me and my wife a house in rural Western Massachusetts. She taught me that there is no devil. She taught me that the world would continue without me. And eventually I learned that lesson. It took some time. It's a tough one for an only child to absorb. Everything is cliché. Her death taught me that life is short. When I kissed her head and smelled her scalp one time near the end of spring and the beginning of summer, she was delusional. She comforted me. "Thank you for visiting me," she said. "Lie down. Get some rest. This is your vacation." A little beyond the safe limits of travel. If you have never driven with a small boat trailer attached to your Jeep, this is what it's like. It's easy. It's easy when you are driving forward. You get used to the extra weight quickly and you just drive along. The only problem is that it is easy to forget what you're doing. And then you take a turn and you can see in your side view mirror that you are being followed by some kind of ghost boat that is floating above the road. And you shriek. Driving backward with the trailer is not easy. Steering in reverse is already an unnatural act, requiring years of brain-scarring experience to feel anything close to instinctive and unterrifying. But now you are also pushing a long aluminum trailer full of Peapod behind you, and it is doing the exact opposite of everything you have learned. If you steer right, it goes left. If you line it up perfectly with where you are trying to push it, say the gravelly slope of the landing at the boatyard, and you begin backing up, it veers off to the right, due either to tiny